The serve, sliced, backhand return. Rafa with a backhand volley, and it's over. Game, set, and match. His third U.S. Open Men's Singles Championship.
Sloan from deep beyond the baseline plays a backhand. Keys a forehand. Sloan just hammering away. Now steps into a forehand. It hangs over. Forehand netted by Keys, and Sloan Stephens is the 2017 U.S. Open champion. A warm hug at the net between the two friends.
Here comes a big smile with Sloan. She can't believe it.
Well, welcome to episode 4 of Courtside, the official podcast of the U.S. Open. And I'm pretty excited today. Nick McCarville here in the host chair. And for the first time, I've got my co-host and tennis historian, Steve Flink, in the room. Steve, an honor, obviously, to be sitting here with you.
And same for me, Nick. It's great to do this.
We've had some great stuff already. And for me, I think we're only going to be building as far as what this podcast is. But thanks to all of you for listening. And in this episode, we've got a lot of exciting things happening. But first off, before we wrap up our Black History Month, last episode we heard from the Williams sisters. You also had a great chat talking about Whirlwind Johnson.
Yes.
Who was very integral in the careers not only of Althea Gibson, but also of Arthur Ashe.
Right.
And the USTA just announced in the last few days that Althea Gibson, another, of course, legend in tennis and for African Americans in sport, they've commissioned a statue for her at the U.S. Open. We don't know if it'll be ready for this year. They haven't picked the artist or the sculptor yet, but Althea Gibson, she is a name that resonates beyond tennis, but I think you probably have a couple memories. Or when you say her name, what sort of pops to mind?
I did. What pops to mind is getting to know her a little bit, working with her a bit in the early 80s when she was on a ranking panel for the International Tennis Federation. Hmm. And it was my job to give the statistics of all the leading players who were in competition for the world champion. As you know, the ITF still does this. They have their annual world champion, number one man and number one woman. And of all the people that I worked with in that time, I remember Althea was the most intense about it, in a good way. She took it really seriously. She wanted every last stat. And she was a perfectionist. And I enjoyed having that brief experience of getting to know her just a little bit.
And what about just overall her legacy? I mean, it sort of speaks for itself, but what she was able to do not only for tennis, but for black women and for female athletes.
Well, that was extraordinary. And Arthur Ashe often said himself that it was Althea who really broke down the barriers, made his task considerably easier than it ever would have been. And Althea, you know, of course, it would be great if they were able to get the statue ready this year, because she won back-to-back Wimbledon and U.S. Championships 57 and 58. So it would be a big anniversary year to celebrate Althea. But I just think she handled herself with a lot of grace and dignity under arduous circumstances.
Yeah. Well, if you did not hear episode 3, where some Althea Gibson mentions are made, make sure to check that out. But really excited to be in the room with you. And so obviously you've had some chats already this year on the podcast. We heard from Virginia Wade a couple episodes ago, and then this episode coming up, you've got a great chat, which I had the chance to listen to with Stan Smith. But what's it been like for you in your role as a Hall of Fame historian to get to kind of walk down memory lane with some of these legends?
Yeah, the reminiscing, Nick, has just been a joy. And just sitting at that table with Virginia while she recollected her 1968 U.S. Open victory and how she was in the zone, and then talking with Stan, which people are going to hear is upcoming now on this podcast. But Stan was terrific, too, because as he recalled winning in 71, he had more to say, I thought, it was about losing in the doubles after winning the singles than he did to try to glorify himself for winning the singles. It pointed to Stan's modesty, and he's very entertaining. I think people will enjoy that discussion immensely.
No, it's a great, great conversation that's coming up here on episode 4. Of Courtside. We also have a great interview. I just had the chance to speak with Savannah Guthrie. She's the Today Show host, and this coming Monday, March 5th, she is actually going to be taking court with Jack Sock and Roger Federer, also Bill Gates. They're playing the Match for Africa, which obviously benefits Roger Federer's foundation. But Savannah fit me into a few minutes of her time to speak with her about that, which was, Savannah's a big tennis fan, which I love, kind of getting these players people outside of tennis who are so excited about the game.
And you've spoken to Katie Couric before.
Yeah,
so
she was...
Same milieu.
Yeah, exactly. And she was on, if you didn't get a chance to listen to Courtside back when we were doing it during the U.S. Open, that is archived as well. One thing before we go to Savannah, it's 50 years of the U.S. Open. It's 50 years of open-era tennis. And that's part of the reason why we're doing Courtside this season is to celebrate that. One thing I didn't realize, which both Stan and Virginia talked at length about, was not all the players were sure what open-era tennis was going to do. Or we know it now as open-era tennis, but they weren't necessarily sure how things were going to change, or should they participate in these events. I find that fascinating because I'm learning through your interview sort of these bits of tennis history.
Yeah, there were tough decisions to be made whether to turn pro. They also had some very odd categories, Nick, like the registered player category. Tom Ocker, who lost to Arthur Ashe, was a so-called registered player. That was almost in no man's land between amateur and pro. Everybody was trying to sort this out. Virginia, who had originally not turned pro, did decide to take the prize money when she won the U.S. Open, all $6,000 of it. So it was really, it was a complicated period. And no, they didn't know exactly where it was headed. They just were hopeful and optimistic that the whole open tennis experiment would succeed, which of course it has royally.
Yeah, well, it's funny for you there to call it an experiment, but it really was at that time. All right, so let's go ahead to get to episode 4. We're going to talk first with Savannah Guthrie, and then Steve and I are going to stay here with you, and we're going to preview the tennis to come in both Indian Wells and Miami as we go through our spring hardcourt swing in the U.S. before we get to the clay. And then lastly, you want to stick around for Steve's chat with Stan Smith, the one and only. He is also a fellow Hall of Famer with our own Steve Flink. Here is, first off, Savannah Guthrie.
Okay, so first off, you have to tell me where your Fed fascination comes from, because there's a lot of, you're not alone. A lot of people love Roger Federer.
I know. I actually have figured out that I am not the only person who knows that Roger Federer is awesome. In fact, I was just at the Olympics, as were you, and I was talking to Lindsey Vonn. She loves Roger
They're
Federer.
They're good friends.
They're really good friends. So, yeah, I don't even know when it began. I know I've, you know, just obviously for a long time thought he was an awesome tennis player. But I think as he got older and he was still at it, I don't know, I just got to be really like nostalgic about him. It's almost like I don't even know if I was a huge, huge fan in the early part of his career when he was winning all the time. It's like I started kind of connecting to him when he was still going for it and not quite winning those titles as much, but always in it. And I just, the more I learned about him and kind of the way he conducts himself professionally, the way he seems to be such a good family man and those adorable double sets of twins, like the whole thing. I'm just like all in with Rog. And then every year around like the summer between the French Open, Wimbledon, and US Open, my obsession gets worse and more acute, you know? And I'm like, it's getting worse and worse every year because I just want him to win so much. And then last year was great because of the Australian Open, and then
Wimbledon,
I died. And then it just, the whole, it just kind of fed on itself. So. Yeah. So to speak, it fed on itself, the Fed obsession. So this is just, I don't know, but I've never met him.
Yeah.
So this...
Never. I think you were supposed to meet him before the U.S. Open last year. It didn't happen.
Right. So this is how it all came about. So I interviewed him after Wimbledon because...
But via satellite.
It was a remote. And I had been posting videos online with my little girl cheering for him. Like, she thinks all tennis players are Roger. Like, if she sees tennis, she goes, Roger.
Got it.
She's three. Anyway, so we'd done something on the Today Show called Summer of Yes, and we all got to pick something we wanted to say yes to, and I said, I'd like to get better at tennis. So through that, the series of doing those stories, the Roger Federer obsession came to be known more widely, and they were trying to connect me with Roger for that series, and I was actually on a flight. I was supposed to go to, I think he was in Cleveland or something, and that's when he got injured right before the U.S. Open, and so they had to cancel. So for that reason, his agent kind of felt bad, and he sent me some tickets to a match, and that's how I made the connection, and they reached out to me for this match for Africa.
Awesome. So you've got some tennis background. I know that you've been busy training.
But yes.
Are you, I mean, because I think it's one thing to meet him, right?
Yes.
And to be in the presence of Roger Federer, but yeah. You're not only going to be on court with him, Jack Sock, Bill Gates,
yeah.
But also just in front of several thousand people in San Jose.
Oh, I know. When I looked up what the SAP Center capacity was, and it's 17,000 people, and I think it's nearly sold out, I'm like dying 1,000 deaths. I mean, first of all, yes, I play a little tennis. I am not good. And in fact, when they asked me to do this, I was very transparent about it. I said, you know, I'm not good at tennis, and yeah. I'm not being modest. I'm telling the truth. And, you know, they're kind of like, well, you don't really have to be that good. It's just one set. You know, this is just for fun. On the other hand, you know, you have to get it over the net.
Yeah.
And I'm living in fear that I'm going to double fault all my serves or, you know, like get air balls or just whiff it or just there's something. Like a million things that could go wrong. I know I'm not going to play very well, but I don't want to totally humiliate myself.
Yeah.
And then for that to be happening at the same time, I'm like, across from Roger, like I'm just gonna, I mean, my head might explode.
Well, that's the other thing, Savannah, is that you're actually not teaming with Roger.
I know.
You're playing with Jack Sock.
I know, which I'm very excited about, and Jack yeah. Sock's an awesome player, and he's a super partner, and I hope he hits all the balls, and I'll just stand there and try to not screw it up. But yeah, I'm playing against Roger, so then I have to like look at Roger.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I'm not gonna say I don't have some anxiety about it, but mostly I'm excited because it's, you know, it's a great cause, and that's the first and foremost. I mean, you don't want to lose sight of that. He did, the Federer Foundation raises millions in this Match for Africa. They do it every year, and mm-hmm. it's a huge mm-hmm. part of his philanthropy, and so it's fun to do it and, you know, try to get publicity for it and get people excited for it because I know it's for a good cause. And then on top of that, I get to hang out with Roger, and that's just kind of amazing. Mm. And I think now what's funny is I know now he's aware that I'm alive and I exist and I am a complete obsessed fan. So I think that's kind of funny too.
Yeah, so mission complete on that front.
Well, right. He knows I exist. Done and done.
You know, you mentioned Lindsey Vonn, and I actually wrote down her name because I think people have become, you know, such in awe of her, of him, yeah. of these athletes. What is that about sort of the human drive, or why do we sort of tend to come to these athletes at a time when, I don't know, maybe they seem more human as they get older?
I think that's what it is. I mean, I think we all admire and are inspired by athletic excellence. But with somebody like Lindsey or Roger, there's something more. There's an X factor. And for me, with Roger in particular, I think it's that he seems to conduct himself with just such grace and generosity, kindness. I love about Lindsey that she never gives up. I always tease her. Never bet against Lindsey because, I mean, my gosh, she's blown out her knee a bazillion times. She's had every surgery. You know, she's been to 4 Olympics, and she's still at it, you know? And I'm very inspired by that because I don't feel I possess any of those qualities, you know? Like, I'd be like, oh, gosh, you know what? My ankle's a little sore. I don't think I should practice today. You know, I'm the opposite of it. So I truly admire that grit and that drive and determination. And I also admire people who have a lot of the spotlight on them and have had since they were young and still manage to just interact with the world and with others with goodness and kindness and generosity. I'm like, you know, you're doing it right. And that's the real reason that I'm a Roger fan. I mean, the tennis is part of it, but it's really, it's all of what I perceive about him. So hopefully he's going to live up to my expectations.
I think he will. I want to know your expectations going out to the U.S. Open. You've been there a couple times.
Yes.
What's that experience been like? Have you been able to watch Roger there and just, I think people don't necessarily know it until they go, but it's quite the affair.
The U.S. Open is amazing. It's one of the things I look forward to every year. There's such an energy. It's got. I think each of the big Grand Slam tournaments have their own personalities, but I love the U.S. Open because it's so connected to the place, New York City. It's kind of loud and boisterous and fun and casual and doesn't seem to take itself too seriously, but you're watching all this great tennis.
Yeah.
Yes. And then it's also just a hilarious who's who because all these people come and you're like, oh my gosh, there's Lin-Manuel Miranda. There's Meryl yes. Streep. There's this one or that one. And so there's sort of that like yeah. Star Wars bar quality to it. I love going. I've gone since I moved back to New York City 5 or 6 years ago. I've definitely gone every year. And the last couple of years, I got to go to the finals. But because of all of this, I'm full circle to Roger. His agent, who felt bad because they had to cancel
yeah,
on
Tony
us.
Tony Gottsick.
Yes. He, when Tony Gottsick sent me some tickets to watch one of the early matches that Roger played.
Yeah.
And I called my husband. It was like, Tony emailed me. It was like 11 a.m. I had a whole afternoon of meetings and things planned. He's like, hey, do you want to come to this match? I'm like, yes.
Of course.
I completely blew off everything. I called my husband. I'm like, I'm picking you up in an hour. We're going out to the U.S. Open. And it was...
And you
that's,
did it.
That's my favorite U.S. Oh, awesome. Open moment. Because first of all, I got to sit down with, like, in the Roger box. Not next to Mirka or anything. That okay. would have been beyond. But yeah. I would have been, like, dying.
Yeah.
I might be more excited to meet Mirka than even Roger.
You have to have your ultimate game face.
I know. Well, I tried Mirka. To do. I was trying to. And I kept saying to Mike, like, my husband, I'm like, I have to act normal. Because these are all people that Roger knows or mm-hmm. their coaches or whatever. So it was really funny because I, of course, was dying. I was in the front row. And there he was, and like, if he looked over in our direction, I was like, I was just dissolved. I was just like, so I don't know how I'm going
to
respond when I act.
No,
I know. It's like, don't be a dork, Savannah, is the main thing.
Okay, so lastly, I want to ask you two last things, really quick. You're in the mainstream. You obviously host the Today Show, but do you think tennis has the chance to kind of make its way back? Because we've got Roger and Serena and Rafa and Venus and all these great stars, but it's lost a little of its cachet versus, say, like the 70s and 80s.
I know. I don't understand that because I grew up, you know, Bjorn Borg and mm-hmm. John McEnroe and then
Jimmy
Sampras,
Connors,
Andre
yeah.
Agassi. I just think tennis is the most exciting, the most watchable sport. I think it's accessible because, you know, you don't have to be very good to be able to go out and hit a few balls. And so, you know, there are tennis courts everywhere. So I don't even like to, you know, accept the premise that tennis is not as big as ever. And whatever I can do to promote it and encourage people, I just think it's a sport you can do your whole life.
Yeah.
I remember being a little kid and going to the racket club with my folks, and they would play tennis together, and we would kind of clown around on the courts. And I went to tennis camp as a little girl. And
yeah.
I just have such a fondness for it. And I actually realized how meaningful it is to me. First of all, I'm not known for my athleticism or gracefulness, and tennis is literally the only sport I can kind of,
good,
sort of
yeah,
do,
that's
kind
great.
Of. And so I really love it, and I hope that people continue to be excited about
yeah.
it and give it a chance.
Well, we love that you love it, and I think that San Jose should be a tryout for you and Raj to play mixed doubles at the U.S. Open.
Oh my gosh, definitely! As long as he covers all of the court,
yeah.
and I'll just stand there and I don't know, do what? Smile.
Oh.
But yeah, I'm really excited. I'm so honored that they asked me to do it, and yeah, we're gonna have fun.
It's the Match for Africa 5 at the SAP Center in San Jose. I think there's tickets still available, and go hang out with Savannah Guthrie and Roger Federer.
Yes, exactly. Hang out with us. And we just released a hype video. It's on the Today website, today.com,
cool.
to try to take on. Bill and Roger had a pretty funny video, so this is our
they
response.
They did, yeah. All right, awesome. Thanks, Savannah.
Thank you.
Well, thanks again to Today Show host Savannah Guthrie. If you did not know already, it's Monday, March 5th. That's this coming Monday. Savannah taking the court. Roger Federer, Bill Gates, Jack Sock. That's at the SAP Center in San Jose. I think tickets are still available. Steve, one thing I didn't say to Savannah is that I wanted her to do a sneak attack by Savannah, which would be Sabs versus Roger
yeah,
Sabre, because
yeah,
they're going to be playing against each other.
Did she get that?
Well, I didn't get the chance to say
oh,
it
all right,
to her.
Okay.
But Savannah, I know you're listening. Try a sneak attack on Roger. Second serve, right?
Absolutely.
All right, well, let's stay with the tennis theme as we do on Courtside. And Steve Flink and I are now going to talk about tennis, which I'm excited about kind of being able to be in the room with you and for all of our listeners to talk about really when the season shifts gears, right? February is always a bit. We've got great events in February, but this is a time when tennis comes back to the States in March. And we've got the Indian Wells Masters, known as the BNP Paribas Open, as well as the Miami Masters, the Miami Open, presented by Itaú. So, first off, Indian Wells, and I think the headlines, at least now, we're recording this on February 28th, Serena Williams is set to come back to professional tennis, hopefully, and also Victoria Azarenka, should she be able to play. So, I guess just the excitement and the question marks revolving around those two stars.
It'd be great for the women's field, even if they got one of them, but hopefully both. And the strange thing, Nick, it's we thought a couple of years ago that if there was anybody set up to be the legitimate rival for Serena Williams, it was Victoria Azarenka. Played her in a couple of U.S. Open finals, beat her a couple of years ago, knocked her off in Indian Wells.
Yeah, in the final 2 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, she was... It seemed in the cards, and then unfortunately a lot of things have intruded since then.
Yep.
But I think it would be fantastic for the field out there to have them both in there, and Serena coming off the doubles and Fed Cup, this is a chance for her to now to reestablish herself again in singles and just find out where she is on the scale of things.
Yeah, Azarenka came back briefly after having had her little son Leo. She came back last summer for a couple tournaments, and then since have had some custody issues with her,
exactly.
with Leo's father, and then Serena becoming a mother herself in
and
September.
It kept Victoria from playing the Australian, too. We hoped that we were going to see her there.
Yeah. Well, and it's kind of a home tournament for Vika, who spends most of her time living in Los Angeles. Serena herself, as you mentioned, played that Fed Cup dead rubbers double with Venus.
Right.
I think that she probably wasn't necessarily happy with where she was in her tennis, but she also was talking about, as we heard in the last episode of Courtside, that she's just kind of playing things by ear. Because you have a baby in September, neither you or I can relate, but she had complications with the birth, and here's Serena Williams in her mid-30s trying to come back to a professional sport that's dominated by women in their 20s.
Yeah, I think she's very realistic about the size of her challenge, and she won't expect that much initially, but by the summer... Interestingly enough, leading up to the U.S. Open, that's where I think if she can stay healthy between now and then, that's going to be Serena Williams rounding into top form.
Yeah, no, I think if anything, we're hopeful for her in Indian Wells and in Miami, but I think that's when she's going to become most dangerous. She'll have the most time then to get her body exactly where she wants it, to get her tennis where she wants it, maybe even as soon as Wimbledon. But definitely.
Possibly. Yeah,
definitely
you're right.
Open.
Wimbledon's a possibility, and it would be great. I mean, obviously, it's the surface suits her to the hilt, but I'm more confident about the Open.
Yeah. Well, another player that we're set to see, hopefully, in both Indian Wells and Miami is Roger Federer, who came off a brilliant Australian Open once again. If you could be more surprised by what Roger did at the Australian Open last year, I think it was what he did this year and ended up winning in a five-set thriller over Marin Cilic, a match that had its own roller coaster. But Roger Federer continues to build his legacy. 20 Grand Slams. You know what stat I loved out at the Australian Open is that the Australian Open was our 200th Open Era Grand Slam. Roger Federer has now won 10% of those.
That's
20.
It's a little bit obscene, isn't it?
Yeah.
No, it's remarkable. It's remarkable because he said many years ago, actually, I think at that point he may have still only had his 15 majors. But I remember him saying, and people thought it was, they didn't think it was arrogant. They thought it was crazy. He said, my goal is 20. He really didn't say it in a manner where he expected it, but that's, who would have believed it? And there's no reason to, at this stage, to think that he can't get a couple more.
I mean, between
this year and next year.
Do you think, so Roger Federer comes in not only as an Australian Open champion, Grand Slam number 20, he's also world number one for the first time again in 5 years, which is, he set all sorts of, or extended all sorts of record, having not been ranked that high since, I think it was 2012 or 13, some 5 years. But I think we're going to see Roger in Indian Wells in Miami, and then I wouldn't be too shocked if he did choose to play the French. We'll remember from last year, he chose to take the whole clay court season off. But the next thing I want to get to, this segues, is you've got Rafa, who's still dealing with hip and knee injuries. You've got Djokovic in his elbow. No Andy Murray until at least Wimbledon, I don't think. And
right.
Stan Wawrinka, who is back, but still nursing some of the side effects from his knee injury.
Yeah, back, but not back.
Yeah.
No, you're absolutely right. Listen, Roger Federer, he's highly intelligent. He's sizing all this up. But what he has to weigh, Nick, is it worth it? Even if Rafa,
yeah,
if his injuries lingered to the point where he couldn't play the French and Roger was aware that he might be out in the clay court season, if that was the scenario, if I were Roger Federer, I still would not go to Roland Garros. Because he had good reasoning last year. The whole point was he didn't want to aggravate his back and he didn't want to re-injure his knee. He succeeded in that. later in the summer at the U.S. Open, the back was a problem, but then he got over it in a hurry. I don't think he would have had the season that he celebrated had he not scheduled so intelligently. The temptation's there to try to round out his record with at least two of every major, but I think he could well hurt his chances at Wimbledon and still not necessarily come through with the French, because the likes, a Dominic Thiem, somebody like that, could upset Roger on the clay, and then I think he's going to be tempted. In the end, I don't think he's going to do it.
Yeah, I think that's sage advice. His chances at Wimbledon would be hurt because he could get hurt again on the clay. It's obviously the most physical, demanding. And I like that you brought up last year in Montreal. He made the final, losing to Sasha Zverev.
Yeah.
But he did sort of re-aggravate that back injury, which then I think played a big effect in his, you know, he did end up making a deep run at the U.S. Open, but losing to Juan Martín Del Potro.
Yeah, he did. And he'd had a couple of five-setters along the way, and he knew. You could tell after the Del Potro match it was the least disturbed I've seen him after a loss. Not that he hadn't tried his hardest, but he knew what he was up against.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting because you look at the scheduling that Roger has. I think that's become his biggest secret weapon, or not secret, very public, of playing selectively. I was surprised to see him play in Rotterdam. He comes through, wins the title there, gets the number one ranking. But then we look at guys like Djokovic, Murray, Wawrinka, Nadal. These are guys who like to play a lot because it suits their style of game, but now they've run into a situation, and it just happened to all happen at the same time, where they're dealing with nagging injuries.
Yeah, and I've talked to the likes of Sam Querrey and Kevin Anderson about that. They all feel it's kind of coincidental, but it's something that certainly Federer is well aware of, and I think it only makes him that much more confident about what he can do for the rest of 2018 at the very least.
Yeah, well, and it's interesting. We're recording this on a day where Rafael Nadal just pulled out of Acapulco. I think he was very hopeful and wanting to play at that ATP 500. But it'll be interesting to see what happens in the next few days. But I think the conversation moving forward for the men's tour overall, and we've seen this in tennis, is body management. How do these players make sure that they stay healthy? Because the tour demands... it's a lot of physicality, especially for the guys at the majors and over five sets in tough conditions. It really is not only about how good of tennis are you playing, but then also how good does your body feel?
Absolutely. It's critical. And they all do their best with the body management dilemma. And they consult with their trainers. But I think no matter how hard the trainers work, Nick, to protect their players, there's no magic formula. The game, the physicality of the game, the physical demands of the game are much greater than they've ever been before.
Well, Roger Federer is the defending champion in Indian Wells. We hope to see him. We hope to see Serena. We also hope to see Vika. But a couple players who had incredible Australian Opens themselves alongside Roger were Caroline Wozniacki and Simona Halep. That was a final for the ages. What a show that both of them put on throughout the tournament, Steve. I mean, it was 2 weeks of brilliant moments for both of them on court.
Absolutely, and what made it, Nick, to one for the ages, as you just said, was that these are two master strategists.
Yeah.
I mean, you think about it, you know, if you watch Venus play Serena or Serena play Maria, and you get so many big hitting matches that are beautifully played, but they're violent. They're quick, fast-paced points. These two women, Halep and Wozniacki, were so acute. Their strategy was right on the whole match. And I think for the fans, it was really enjoyable stuff to see them battle through three sets. And they knew one of them was going to come away with their first major. I was very happy for Wozniacki. Long overdue, and she's on the board, and maybe she can garner another before she's through.
Well, I spoke to her after for the Australian Open, and she said, I'm so happy to never get the question again about being a slamless player, full stop, but she also returned to the number one ranking. It's interesting, we've got Rafa and Roger battling for number one on the men's side, and Caroline and Simona Halep trading that spot on the women's side. And, you know, I think Simona Halep is going to win a major at some point in her career.
I do too.
I felt for her and Darren Cahill because she's worked so hard now. She's 0-3 in major finals, but she has the talent to do it, and I think now she's... And Kim Clijsters was a player, I think, who reached four major finals, also part of the Hall of Fame with you, who before she won that first. So I think Simona feels like
she kept running. Kim kept running into Justine Henin, that her countrywoman, her very gifted countrywoman. So that did not make matters easy. And then she lost one of the three of them were to Justine, and then she lost the one to Jennifer Capriati, which was at 12-10 in the third, you know, a beauty in Roland Garros. But you're right. You have to persevere. It happened with Andy Murray and Yvonne Lendl. They had to wait a long time to their fifth crack. So I agree. I think Simona has the determination and she has that staying power, and sooner or later she's gonna get that major.
Yeah. Well, it's exciting to see, you know, a player like Wozniacki, who, you know, I think that there are people on both sides of the aisle, if you love Caro, if you don't love her. But what she's been through, and, you know, falling outside the top 50, having injuries, you know, not go her way. She reached two major finals before this Australian Open. I loved Steve, and I don't think anyone gets sick of watching the greats like Roger and Serena win majors. But the emotion in the moment for Caroline Wozniacki when she won the Australian Open, that was awesome.
It was, and especially gratifying for her because she had to fight so hard for it. The early stages of the match, Nick, I thought she might win comfortably, and she was up 5-2 in the first set. That eventually went to a tie break, and eventually she had to really exert herself tremendously to win that match in three, which made it all the more rewarding.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, a few players also that had great Australian Opens, not champions per se, but champions in their own right. I'm just going to name off a few of these names, and then let's talk about a couple of them. But Young Chung, the Korean player, making the semifinals, a surprising run for him. Elise Mertens, the Belgian, also making the semifinals. Kyle Edmund from Great Britain making a deep run. Angelique Kerber, we saw her back. She had match points to get into the final.
Right.
Marin Cilic, Madison Keys, Tennis Sandgren. And then we're also going to see Maria Sharapova. She only made the third round at the Australian Open, but she'll be back at Indian Wells for the first time in 2 years after she served her doping ban.
And she was just beaten by a top-of-the-line Kerber.
Oh, Kerber
looked
so good. Can we start with Kerber? I mean, sure. She's back, right?
Oh, I think so, because, look, she opened her season. She won the first tournament in Australia, pre-Australian tournament. Had two match points against Halep in the semis of the Australia. Since then, she's had a loss to Wozniacki. She's only losing to her fellow top players. The consistency so far in 2018, it looks like the Kerber of 2016, not the one that paled in comparison last year. So I'm very encouraged about her, and I think that, you know, that she's reached a high standard again, and that she will contend for number one. She will be in that race, I'm convinced, with the two that we mentioned, of course, you know, who met in the Australian Open final, and that's, of course, Simona and Caroline.
Well, and what I like about a Simona, a Caro, and now Angie is that these are traditionally defensive players.
Right.
And they've found that next gear of being able to be defensive. But also, I think Wozniacki won the Australian Open because she was serving better than she ever has before and being aggressive. And we saw that from Kerber. Of course, she's going to be a back wall against a player like Sharapova. But she was stepping in and taking advantage of the ball she needed to. And that, I hope, is the kind of tennis they can play moving forward.
Yeah, I agree. I thought Kerber did that a little bit better against Maria when she beat her. In the semis, there was a slight caution, but it was an extraordinary match. And they both played a great match, and it was going to be a heartbreaker for either one to lose. But Kerber is the mindset is there again. And I'm not quite sure what happened to her a year ago when all of the self-belief would just eroded.
I think it was just a case of the sophomore slumps. I mean, she won the Australian Open. She won the U.S. Open. She was a Olympic finalist, a Wimbledon finalist. That was a great final against Serena. She reached world number one. I think she just got overwhelmed by all of it. These tennis players are human.
No, you're right.
And,
you're right.
You know, that was her slump year, but I think she's back in 2018. What about the run of Young Chung? Because I was in Melbourne, and I got to sort of experience it on the ground, but how did you witness what Young Chung was able to do, the youngster from South Korea becoming the first Korean singles player in history to make a Grand Slam semifinal? It was a breakthrough, I think, earlier than we thought from him, beating Alexander Zverev, beating a somewhat hampered Novak Djokovic, but he feels like a next-gen player that's now Jen, and someone that we should be watching for.
No doubt about it. I mean, in the fifth set against Zverev, the one that you mentioned, 5 points he lost, five. And then he played very well in the tight corners against Djokovic because, you know, there were two tie breaks, and the middle set was 7-5. And you would have thought in those crunch corners of that match. That's where Novak's experience would have told. But Chung really was terrific under pressure. And he fended Novak off. And he, as a lot of people said, and I tend to agree, he out-Djokovic'd Djokovic.
He did, yeah.
Because, you know, the elasticity, the defense, it was a great match to watch. Great spectator match. Felt a little sorry for Djokovic, who was still clearly having a problem with that elbow. But great moment for Chung. Unfortunately, he couldn't finish with the blisters against Roger, which was a shame in the semis.
Yeah, no, I actually forgot about that. It was a disappointing end to what was a great tournament for young Chung, but I like that, the elasticity, and also he out-Djokovic. That was the talk on social media, is that a lot of people felt like it was a new gen, a now-gen version of Novak beating himself, but I hope that Novak's able to manage that elbow injury, because I wasn't quite sure in Australia. It felt like he was back, and then he was saying he had issues, and he changed his serve.
And then he started tampering with it again.
He reverted back.
Yeah, he reverted back, and that's when you knew that that's a bad sign. Because, and I couldn't blame him, because he obviously thought maybe he wasn't getting quite enough on it. I don't know if it was a question of velocity or placement or comfort, but to revert back a little bit toward the old motion was a sign that he's just not where he wanted to be. And then you could see he definitely didn't serve well enough against Chung.
Yeah. Well, and that's one thing I think with, you know, Murray, Djokovic, Rafa, Stan, we talk about it a lot with Roger, but they do have some of the best serves in the game.
Yeah.
And it's an important aspect for them. And Djokovic, if you look at his serving stats, he doesn't jump out like an Isner or Karlovic or a Roger, but he's got a big serve.
Oh, yeah, but good, but mainly just incredibly precise.
Yeah.
And in fact, I thought that when they had Roger, after he lost back-to-back Wimbledon finals to Djokovic in 14 and 15, and then he lost the Open final in 15, and again in the 16 Australian. And after many of those matches, Novak served really, really well. And Roger didn't seem to be able, he didn't want to give him full marks on it. I was surprised, because I thought it reminds me somewhat of Federer in the sense that he could lay it on a dime. You know, he could find any corner at any time, deceptive. And in Novak's case, he backs it up so well. But that's going to be crucial going forward, Nick, that he's able to serve with comfort again. That's where we're really going to find out about that elbow.
Well, you remind me of the fourth set of the final for Federer and Cilic, when Roger served perhaps the worst any of us have ever seen. I think he was 33% first serve in against Cilic. But maybe Marin, or what are a couple other sort of last thoughts from you on the Australian Open?
Well, my one regret, I think it was a terrific match. Slow start from Cilic, then he recovers. Roger plays a brilliant third. Roger's up 3-1 in the fourth. You think it's over. Marin runs off five straight games, and we had the makings, what I thought of a really blockbuster fifth set. But when Marin had two break points eluded him in the first game of the fifth, Roger took off from there. There's what we saw, the difference between a great champion and a great player. There's a difference. And the difference is, if the roles reverse and Roger had a couple break points at the start of the fifth set and didn't convert, he would have kept competing. He would have stayed in there strong. Marin got a little discouraged, and before you knew it, it was a 6-1 set.
Yeah, it's so interesting to see those differences of the top champions, because Marin Cilic, a Grand Slam winner himself,
right,
in the Wimbledon
right.
final last year, he's got to work on those little itty bitty intangibles.
He does, and you have to. It's not that he stopped trying, but you got to put up a brave front and sort of just put those disappointments behind you in a hurry and move on. Federer does that really well, and Rafa Nadal, probably nobody better at it.
Well, coming up, Indian Wells, this coming 2 weeks, we go to the desert. Many people have called it the fifth Grand Slam. It is a beautiful sight, venue. Roger Federer's defending champion. Elena Vesnina was the surprise champion on the women's side there last year. And then that's to be followed by the Miami Open, where you also have Roger Federer as defending champion, having that absolute blockbuster in the semifinals against Nick Kyrgios, and then beating Rafael Nadal in the final. And the women's defending champ is Johanna Konta. So we've got a lot of great tennis to look forward to this month in the U.S.
Yeah, you're right. And I think that the Federer-Kyrgios match was probably the match of the year. Normally I would want to choose one from the majors, but that was just a dandy and came right down to the final set tiebreak, and Nick imploded a bit, could have tried to serve it out at 5-4, but it was an electrifying match. And I'm hoping we're going to see a lot more of those two in the next couple of years, because Kyrgios is not afraid of Federer and vice versa. So it's an ideal matchup.
Well, and if we, you know, I wish we should have done sort of like a full episode talking about the Australian Open, but Nick had a great tournament. Obviously, I think disappointed to lose to Grigor Dimitrov, but he managed himself really well, beating Joe Wilfred Tsonga, his first win on Rod Laver Arena. And I think it's slow, but I think it's sure that Nick Kyrgios is coming into his own, figuring out who he is as a person, and hopefully that's going to mean better tennis moving forward.
Yeah, I think it will, and I think he could be a really crucial player in the years ahead because he's got so much charisma and he's got so much game that you want to see him do justice to himself.
Yeah. Well, exciting stuff coming at Indian Wells. They have site renovations. They've got a lot of new stuff there. If you've never been, at some point you've got to get there. A new shade structure that they've just put up this year. More palm trees from Larry Ellison, which is great. And then lastly, I want to touch on, this is the last year of the Miami Open at Crandon Park at Key Biscayne. That famed venue, they're moving. They'll go to the Miami Dolphins stadium and then build a tennis center there.
Yep.
They've also announced the one and only James Blake will be the new tournament director, with Adam Barrett moving over to sort of a executive director. He'll still oversee, I think, the tournament itself. But I thought that was a great move to have someone like James. We're still in Black History Month, who's been a great face, name, and champion of the game, to be helming that effort there.
I don't know about you, Nick, but I have never heard an unkind word uttered in the direction of James Blake. So I think he starts off with, it's such a head start for him, because the players, though the veterans know him so well, and I'm sure the younger players will also revere him. And I think it's a good role for James. I think he'll grow into it very quickly, and he'll do an excellent job.
Can I ask you, too, because, you know, James is stepping into that role in Miami. Tommy Haas has served as somewhat of, you know, tournament director in Indian Wells while still playing a little bit. And then Feliciano Lopez was announced in Madrid to take over that tournament in 2019 once he's done playing. Former champions, players who have been at the top of the game, they've stayed in tennis. I mean, that's not something new, but it is new a little bit to have these guys coming right off the back of their careers into these roles, and hopefully some of the women too. I know that Eva Maioli's been very involved in the St. Petersburg event. Yeah, what do you think about that? The players know the game in a different way, I think, than anybody else.
They do. No, I think most of them are going to succeed handsomely. I think that until now, Nick, we always thought of these players automatically moving into the broadcast booth. So maybe there's other avenues opening up. And I think James is going to be extraordinary.
I'm going to put Steve Flink on the hot seat. Do you have champion predictions? Let's just go with Indian Wells. It's too far out to know from Miami. But who's going to be our champs in Indian Wells?
You know, I'm gonna go with Federer, because I think he's primed for it again, and with the sort of the disarray in the top 10, things being what they are, so many injured players, I kind of like his chances to defend. The women's, I'm less certain, but I'm gonna go with Simona Halep.
Very good. Those were the two names I had in my head. So we at least agree on one thing.
So we either succeed together or we can't call it a failure if we're wrong. They're only predictions.
Stay tuned. But we're going to go ahead and transition now to Steve Flink's chat with Stan Smith. And I've already had the chance to listen to this interview. It's insightful. It's fun. Stan Smith has a role now at the International Tennis Hall of Fame, which you talked to him about. But what are a couple of things that you really loved about talking to Stan Smith about?
I love the way that he examined his own career in such an... He was not self-centered. He was self-effacing rather than self-centered. And I loved what he had to say in many respects about Arthur Ashe, the player, the man, the naming of the stadium after Arthur. And his voice at one stage started... I thought it started to crack just a bit as he spoke about Arthur, because they were really a very close friend. So that's what kind of stood out to me. But Stan's very entertaining in the interview, and I've always found him that way, that he's underrated in that facet of his life.
All right, well, here is an underrated Stan Smith. He over-delivers in his chat with Steve Flink.
Stan, it's nice to be with you here to recognize, of course, the 50th anniversary of the U.S. Open, which first went back in 68. But for you, Stan, obviously the seminal moment was in 1971 when you won that was your first Grand Slam tournament triumph. What are your recollections about that final round, especially when you beat Jan Kodesh in a well-played four-set final?
Well, first of all, it's pretty hard to believe it's been 50 years since 68 when Arthur won it. And then, of course, just a couple years later when I was able to win it. But it was an unusual kind of a situation because the actual semifinals were rained out on Saturday. They were rained out on Sunday. They were rained out on Monday. And we played on Tuesday.
The semis on Tuesday.
The semis on Tuesday.
Right,
so,
right.
And, of course, the finals on Wednesday. So it was pretty unusual. After I beat Ocker in the semis, I had to play doubles. We were able to play with spikes. It was pretty interesting. They had the three courts and the center court of Forest Hills. And so we played the singles on the outside courts, the two different semis. And then the courts were so wet, they were trying to preserve that center court, I believe. And then we were able to wear spikes. They allowed us to wear spikes on that on one of the center courts, the outside center court in the stadium. And so they weren't going to use it again, so they weren't worried about it being too chewed up. And we were able to actually play quite well with spikes, and our opponents didn't have spikes.
Damn,
anyway, that
you,
was
for you as a big man, though. You're 6'4", unusually tall for your time. How difficult was it to sort of deal with those spikes and get and move the way you wanted to on that court?
The spikes allow you to really, you know, get a holding, but you got to make sure you lift up your feet, because if you didn't lift up your feet, you could turn your ankle quite easily. Eric Van Dillen, my partner, moved magnificently during that time. He just glided around and didn't ever slip, and the other guys were slipping like crazy. But
so obviously you managed to defeat Ocker, and then waiting for you in the finals is Jan Kodesh, who had beaten Arthur Ashe. So what was the challenge like to beat Kodesh, and what do you remember most about that triumph?
Well, he had beaten Newcomb as well. Actually, maybe that was the next year he beat Newcomb, but he was
he beat him. You're right. He beat him in the first round that year.
In the first round, he was kind of an upset, but big upset. But he was playing great. And the funny thing that happened was Pancho Segura, who just passed away, unfortunately, worked with me from age 15 to 18, and he made a huge impact on my game, especially my strategic point of view. And so I hadn't really seen him too much, but he happened to be there. And he actually walked with me as I walked from the clubhouse to the center court. And he said, "You got to do these three things against Kodesh." I said, "Well, what do you mean?" He says, "Well, you got to attack his second serve, run around and hit forehands on the second serve. It's weak. You got to make sure you lob him because he closed so much and he was very quick. And he moved back pretty well, but he wasn't the tallest guy out there. So the lob was going to be effective." And then he said, "You should kick the ball to his forehand." That's an unusual strategy. People, when they kick, usually kicking it to the backhand. But anyway, the first set, I served really well. I served, you know, a lot of first serves, hard and flat, and end up losing the set.
Yeah. Well, he was a great returner, right, Stan?
And well, he was a good returner. Plus, he liked the ball low. And if you hit it hard and flat on that wet grass court, it stayed low. And it was right in a strike zone. So I suddenly remembered that maybe I should try to kick it. So I ended up kicking a lot of balls as first serves to the forehand, and he has continental grip on his forehand. He didn't like that high ball in the forehand, so it really started paying off as the match went along, and I was able to get win the second and third sets and get into the fourth set.
So in the end, Segura's words certainly rang in your ears, and you managed to beat Jan, who, of course, a couple years later beat you in a heartbreaking match in the semifinals. So
that's right.
I mean, how satisfying was it? That's the U.S. Open. You're an American. It's your first major. How long did all of that take to sink in?
Well, it was interesting because it was the second year of the tiebreaker, and I had played seven tiebreakers during that tournament. And the seventh was that fourth set against Kodesh, and I ran around, hit some forehand winners on returns, and I hit a pretty crucial lob during that tiebreaker as well. So those elements that Segura had mentioned to me really did pay off. And it was an odd thing because we actually played doubles after that. I had to go in and shower, then had a bite to eat, met the press. And it was getting later and later. So we went out, played the doubles, and we were up 2-1. Newcomb fell down and looked like he was hurt. The doctor came out, and those times the doctor couldn't do anything he wanted. And it got delayed, and we ended up losing the fourth set. And by this time, it was getting dark, really dark. And nobody wanted to stay for the fourth day, that's Thursday, to finish the tournament of the third week of the tournament. And so we decided to split the prize money and play a 9-point tiebreaker for the title. And we ended up being 3-3 with Eric Van Dillen, my partner, to serve against Newcomb and Taylor. And Newcomb ran around, hit a forehand after Eric missed his first serve, and Eric missed a volley. Then Eric missed his first serve against Taylor. Taylor ran around, hit a forehand, and then Newcomb poached. We lost the match. It was very disappointing because we were kind of in control of the match, really. But anyway, it was interesting because in the dark, we finished the tournament. And then I was supposed to play in San Jose or someplace the next week. But, of course, the tournament had already been well on its way. And I didn't want to play anyway. You know, when you win something like that, you just want to relax. And we actually went out to California and just hung out, played a little golf. And I got a call from the White House, supposedly. And so in the morning, it was like 9 in the morning, and we were just about to walk out the door to play golf. And this lady says, well, this is so-and-so from the White House. President Nixon would like to speak to you. And I said, oh, sure. You know, it's one of our friends, you know, joking with us. And so I just offhand, I said, well, you know, okay, we're not going to be here for a while, but, you know, maybe at 5 o'clock, if he wants to call, you know, he can call. And we got back, and at 5 o'clock, President Nixon called and congratulated me for winning the tournament. So that was a nice call to get.
Well, those were all great memories for you, Stan. But, you know, obviously that win in 71, it was very early in the Open era. You had sort of emerged in, you know, the stages leading up to the Open tennis. What was the feeling like to be a player, you know, young player like yourself, seeing the emergence of Open tennis and having that first Open in 68? Did you feel like you had really sort of timed your journey well?
Well, my life is, timing's been unbelievable in my life. I changed the junior categories from 11, 13, 15, and 18. For some reason, they had a gap there, and they changed it to 12, 14, 16, and 18, just the year I turned 16. So I was able to get a couple of lucky breaks in the summer after my senior year, and was able to get a scholarship to Southern California based on just a couple matches that just happened to go my way. And so there's been so many things in my life that's worked well. And this is a good example. 1968, I graduated from college. And those 4 years during the summers of my collegiate career, I played all these tournaments on the East Coast, which were, you know, Philadelphia, Boston, New Jersey, Baltimore, and then also, of course, the U.S. Open. And so I was able to play the U.S. Open after the year I played and won the National Junior Championships in 1964. So I played the U.S. Open all those years, and I played all those other tournaments in the summer, and we're playing the same guys as we played in 1968-69 when tennis became open.
Yeah, of course, it was the U.S. So, you had previously, obviously, it was the U.S. Nationals, but you're saying you're facing a lot of the same guys.
Facing the same guys, the same venues, and all of a sudden there was prize money. And during my college years, of course, I couldn't accept prize money. You know, once I graduated, I was able to accept, you know, prize money. The prize money was in all those summer tournaments were $25,000 total prize money. The winner got $5,000 and it went down from there. So it wasn't like there was a lot of prize money, but there was prize money in those tournaments starting in 68. And of course, the winner for the U.S. Open in 1968 was $14,000, which Arthur didn't even get to accept because he was not eligible for that. I actually won $20,000. I was really, you know, fortunate to be able to get that much money.
Stan, obviously you were a very close friend of Arthur Ashe. You were on the Davis Cup team with him in 68. He played the singles and you're in the doubles. And what are your recollections about that historic win of his in 68, and how surprised were you by it?
Well, it was an amazing period of time. Certainly Arthur's victory was one of the highlights, one of the positive highlights of 1968. Of course, Robert Kennedy was assassinated. Martin Luther King was assassinated. Muhammad Ali became a conscientious objector, and that was big news. And there was amazing things that happened in 1968. But the most positive highlight was Arthur winning and playing some great tennis. You know, he was a slasher this is why I described him in his early years. He would just go for broke on serves. He had one of the best serves in the game, if not the best. He wasn't a big, strong guy. He was 6'2 or so, but not a strong, you know, looking guy, but he had great timing and he was strong in his own sinewy way, but he would just go for shots on returns of serve. You know, if you got in his strike zone, he would be going for a big shot. And if he was on, he was the best player in the world. If he was off, then he would struggle a bit. later on in his career, as he got towards the mid-70s, when he won Wimbledon in 75, he became more of a thinker and had some guile as well as power. And so that was an interesting transition with him, because when you played him late 60s and the mid-60s, he was just going for shots, and if he was on, you almost didn't have any say in what would happen.
And you think that was essentially what happened then in 68 at the Open, that, you know, he'd had a great summer and you'd been in the semis of Wimbledon, and then he really was sort of peaking and all the shots were coming off for him that year in the 68 Open?
He was gaining so much confidence. You know, we played 6 Davis Cup matches that year. We played in Richmond, which was significant, obviously, to Arthur to play that first round against the British West Indies in Richmond. And then we played in Mexico. He killed Rafael Osuna, again, just taking Osuna's second serve and just drilling it and serving unbelievable. Then we played Ecuador in Charlotte. And then we played Spain in Cleveland on pretty fast courts. He had to play Santana, Manolo Santana, in a dead match. It was a fifth match. We'd already clinched it, but it was like 4.5 hours. It was a crazy long match, but all throughout that year in 68, he played a lot of tennis. He built a lot of confidence, I think, from playing Davis Cup. And he didn't lose in Davis Cup that year, leading up to the Open and then after the Open when we played the last couple matches. And so he was playing with great confidence, and he was going for shots, and they were going in. And of course, we're playing on grass at Wimbledon. We're playing at grass at the U.S. Open. Bad grass, by the way, where the ball was bouncing low and staying low, and his slice serve was cutting out wide and staying low and was very effective. And he was the best player at the time. And I'll never forget when he received the trophy and he's wearing his USA Davis Cup sweat top and his father was standing next to him. So that was a special moment, because Arthur's father was a policeman and had drilled in respect, discipline, hard work, no trash talking on the court, playing hard and fair and giving your opponent the due when they beat you. So seeing him there in the photograph with Arthur holding the trophy and wearing the USA jacket with his father next to him was a photograph that I'll never forget.
Yeah, Life magazine put it on the cover. I won't forget it either. It was a very poignant moment. Now, Stan, as the Open era unfolded there, I mean, you had some remarkable success year after year in the early stages, because you won those U.S. Nationals in 69 that was still at Longwood, led up to the Open, and then you won the first Masters in Tokyo in 70. Then you got your U.S. Open in 71, followed by Wimbledon in 72, along with a phenomenal Davis Cup triumph in Romania, and all ending in terms of your dominance with the WCT Finals in 73. What do you remember most about that period in terms of the confidence you were building, how the Open obviously all fit into that? That was maybe the best moment, along with Wimbledon the following year. But that stretch where you seemed year after year to be able to rise to the occasion.
Well, it was a good stretch. And in 1968, again, the timing of my life was great. I got to play Davis Cup in 1968. And then for the next 4 years, and then actually 5 years after that, we lost in 73. So we won in 68, 69, 70, 71, 72. So I was on 10 Davis Cup teams, and we won 7 times, and it was really the most, I guess, fulfilling thing to be able to play for the country. When you have the Olympics going on, it reminds you about what it's like to play Davis Cup, to sit there and know that you're representing 200 at that time, maybe 250, now 300 million people. Most of them didn't know you were playing necessarily, but the fact they're playing the national anthem, they're raising the flag, they're calling the score out as a game set to the United States, you know, it was a great thrill. So that part of my career was fantastic. And to win the U.S. Open, being the our country's U.S. Open, was you know, tremendously fulfilling. And I remember in 1970, I guess we were playing the Masters, and I think I overheard or I read that Ken Rosewall thought I was the favorite or one of the favorites. And that was one of the things that really changed my thinking, because I said, you know, if this guy, who was maybe the best player in the world, he and Laver, thought I was a favorite, then maybe I'm a good player. And it gave me the confidence. And another thing that happened that year in the 70 was I lost to Pancho Gonzalez at Wembley. And Jack Kramer came up to me after the match. I had match point. Very disappointing to lose. You know, Gonzalez was like 95 years old at the time, it seemed. Anyway, he said, "Hey, kid, you know you're playing well. Don't worry about this, and keep working on it, and you're gonna do well." And so, I went on to win the doubles at Wembley. Then I won the singles and doubles in Stockholm, and then went to Tokyo and won the singles there. And then we won the doubles later in Montreal. So it was a great stretch. But you know, certain comments here and there, and people that have helped me along the way, really got me going. And then obviously I built the confidence. I felt, you know, I was a favorite. And 73, we go into Wimbledon, and I was seeded one and certainly one of the favorites, defending champion. And we didn't play that year. You know, I felt it was the right thing to do to support the players and to support the ATP, our fledgling new association that really bonded because of that boycott at Wimbledon. It was a fun period of time to see the game really grow dramatically and be part of that and to be one of the players that was doing well during that time. It was exciting.
Now, Stan, mm-hmm. 10 years after Arthur won it was when the big move took place from Forest Hills to Flushing Meadows, and you still were out there and you won a couple of doubles titles there. And what do you remember about that phase of the Open, shifting from the private club at Forest Hills where it had been there for decades and moving to this public facility at Flushing Meadows, which took a monumental effort on the part of Slew Hester and so many other people? What do you remember about those early years that when you competed there and what the feeling was like among the players and the public about this new place for the U.S. Open?
Well, everybody was a little bit nervous about it, but when you look back at 50 years from when it happened, or 40 years from when it happened, it was amazing they could ever play the U.S. Open in a very small venue at Forest Hills in a private residential community. It was crazy. And the same thing at Kooyong in Australia, in Melbourne. It was the same sort of setup with a private club and a private community. The fact that they could actually play a major tournament in something like that was crazy. And the French, of course, is the same way. And Wimbledon's the same way today. It was, I think, an important step for the U.S. championships to be played in a public facility that was formerly the World's Fair venue, and to hopefully get more of the public involved in not only watching the matches in person, but watching on television and hopefully playing more. And it was significant that this was a public facility and that people hopefully played tennis in public facilities, and to have such great, you know, support there with the New Yorkers, and as you mentioned, Slew Hester was a big part of getting that thing done, and to move the Armstrong Stadium into a tennis facility was quite unique, and the ground below it wasn't very good either, so that was a kind of a dangerous move because it was built over a dump, and it was, the ground was very unstable, so they had to do a lot of work just to get that facility, you know, stable enough that it would not end up being, you know, bumpy and develop cracks and that sort of thing. But the U.S. Open really became open when it went to Flushing Meadows.
But obviously, with what you've just said, to sort of sum it all up, it became something much more substantial once it had gone to this totally different kind of an atmosphere in the public facility. And don't you believe that the sports public at that stage started to embrace it more and take it more seriously as a major sporting event?
I think so. I think that people, first of all, it was such a big arena for us at the time and a big facility. And, of course, right next to Shea Stadium with the parking there and the trains coming right there, it was a major event. And New York embraced it. The fans embraced it. The television got bigger and bigger, you know, when it moved there. And so it really became the biggest event in New York, and it still is.
So, Stan, now then obviously it took a long time, but in 97, 19 years later, that Arthur Ashe Stadium was built. What was your feeling about having it become Arthur Ashe Stadium? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that was a gutsy effort on the part of the USTA, because there would have been any number of corporations that would have loved to have their name on that court. And, of course, the Billie Jean King Tennis Center was the next move that was it was another great move to have two of our greatest champions with their names on that facility. So I applauded that dramatically. Arthur will go down as the very best player that's ever played the game, but the impact that he had on the game was significant, just the same as Billie Jean. Those two have impacted the game much more dramatically than any other American player that's ever laced up their shoes. And so it was a great move. The players, I think, applauded it as well.
Well, obviously, Stan, yeah, you alluded to Billie Jean, and that was in 2006. But how do you think he would have felt about this incredible honor to have that stadium named after him?
He would have been surprised. You know, he never expected all the adulation that he got, you know, when he was living and that he got after he passed. But he was a significant personality, I guess you'd say, that was much bigger than the game. And same with Billie Jean. So that you got two people that have impacted society in such a dramatic way, and to have them, you know, featured in our U.S. championship is very significant and appropriate. And you know, those decisions were fantastic. I can't say enough for what they'd done for the game. And you know what, the game is for everybody. Those are two great champions that illustrate that point.
Now, Stan, you took over from Tony Trabert about 7 years ago as the president of the International Tennis Hall of Fame. Personally, what has that meant to you? And then talk about the relationship with the Open, which featured the ring ceremony for Kim Clijsters last year, who was a member of the class of 2017, and she was honored out in Arthur Ashe Stadium.
Well, the Hall of Fame has been a great institution. It's been the opportunity to really honor all the great players and contributors that have served the game for really the history of the game. As of this last year, we've really gone back to all the players in the history. So we've gotten players that were not part of the Hall of Fame and had passed away a long time ago to get them in the Hall of Fame. So now we have all the players that have ever played. I call them the greatest players that have ever played. We're raising the bar with the Hall of Fame and making sure that only significant players are getting into it and significant contributors are getting into the Hall of Fame. So that has been important. Tony Trabert was a great president, and it's ironic in a way. He had a tennis racket made by Wilson. They took his name off that racket, and I think they had Barry McKay's on his name on it. Then I put my name on that very same racket, so I'm following him again in the Hall of Fame as the president. Our biggest emphasis is to make it truly international. People think of the Hall of Fame, the International Tennis Hall of Fame, and they think of only American players, but you know, over 50% of the players in the Hall of Fame are international players, and it's going to be even higher than that as we go along. So it's an important institution worldwide, and we're trying to get the word out so that people around the world understand that, and that we're honoring the great players from their countries as well as America. The U.S. Open has really been great to support the Hall of Fame in many ways. We have a U.S. Open wing at the Hall of Fame. We were able to do this ring presentation to Kim Clijsters on center court before the women's final. So it's great to see the support of the U.S. Open with the International Tennis Hall of Fame. Before we get off the subject of the Hall of Fame, we have a couple significant, relatively new inductees in the Hall of Fame, and one of those is Steve Flink.
Well,
and so it's been great to see Steve Flink honored as a great historian, writer, TV commentator that has done so much for the game.
Now, Stan, we couldn't possibly close this interview without a mention about the Stan Smith tennis shoe, because obviously here you are so many years later and that shoe is thriving, and in some ways you're better known for the shoe than you were for your tennis, which is, I'm wondering whether that brings sadness to you or puts a smile on your face. But talk about how the remarkable evolution of that shoe and what it's meant to your life.
The shoe has been kind of a strange tale. Starting in 1972, in the end of that year, the shoe had my name on it, and it's been on it ever since. It was really started by Horst Dassler, who was Adi Dassler's son, and Robert Haye, who was the number one French player at the time. And they created the shoe, the first leather tennis shoe ever made. Before that, we wore canvas shoes. And I actually got to wear the Haye shoe for a year or so before they put my name on it. And the reason they put my name on it was that they wanted to get a little stronger presence in the U.S. market. And so I happened to be the number one player at the time. So that was, again, one of those magical things in the timing of my life that it could have been later on where they put maybe Jimmy or John or Chrissy or Billie Jean or somebody else on the shoe. And just turned out to be the right. I was in the right place at the right time with the right product, and it was one of those products that just doesn't have too many bells and whistles. It's kind of simple and plain and not too extravagant price wise, and very comfortable, and goes with almost anything you want to wear. And
you even wear it sometimes for these celebrations at like the,
well,
the Australian,
yeah,
Open.
I mean, it's now I've now become a fashion icon around the world, which is kind of funny because it's not necessarily my nature. But anyway, it's at last in 2012 and 13 they took it off the market. Then they brought it back in January 15th of 2014 worldwide, and they've done it totally with social media and with collaborations with various hip hop people, models, artists, all sorts of folks. Pharrell Williams is affiliated now with Adidas and doing some designing with it. Kanye West has been working with Adidas as well, and other designers have been involved. Raf Simons is a great designer, is now designing some things, particularly with my shoe. And so it's caught the eye of young people and older people, as men and women, boys and girls of all ages. And so it's been kind of fun, I guess, more than anything else. And I wear it a bit myself.
As we close this interview out, I would love to get you to sort of put in perspective now this 50th anniversary year. First of all, as someone who was around in that period and playing those tournaments at the time, and then one of the early Open champions in 71, put into perspective how this event has grown and how the U.S. Open has changed since those early days, and what you think is most significant about it all in terms of how far the sport has evolved over this half century.
Well, when I first played there in 64, I guess it was, and then as an amateur in the U.S. National Championships, before it became the Open, it was a country club sport, and we were wearing white, and there weren't many people that weren't white that were playing the game. And the transition that's taken place over the years has been all positive. You know, Arthur was actually quite involved in writing the code of conduct for how players should act. And before my time, we had some really bad actors. During my time, we had some bad actors. And after my time, we did. But they were getting coded. You know, eventually we have very talented officials, linesmen, and umpires. We now have this challenge system, which has eliminated a lot of the haggling. I wish it had been around when I was playing Ili Nastasi, when he had the five-minute tirades of we'd have to wait for him to finish up and for the umpire to say, let's move on. And the television has just been dramatic with great coverage. It's become even much more worldwide now than ever before. So a guy like Roger Federer is beloved in the United States at the U.S. Open, as he is at the French, as he is at Wimbledon, and the Australian. And so is, you know, Nadal, Djokovic, Martina Navratilova has become an American. We've got, you know, great Steffi Graf and players from all over the world that have won the U.S. Open that are household names in the United States because of what's transpired, that the evolution of everything as far as training for tennis players in places like Croatia and Serbia and India and Africa. It's really driven the interest in the game, and it's fantastic to see what's taken place. It's a business, but still, if you talk to the top players, they play the game because they love the game.
Well, Stan, thank you very much for appearing with us on this podcast. It's been, time's gone by very quickly, and I've enjoyed getting your views on such a wide range of subjects, and I hope we'll catch up again soon.
Well, thank you for having me on, and I'll see you at the U.S. Open, 50th anniversary. It's going to be great.
You got it.
Well, thanks again to Stan Smith. I loved that chat you had with him, Steve, and you've got great guests coming up on Courtside.
We do, Nick. And the next one following Stan is the only player ever to win two Grand Slams in the history of tennis, Rod Laver. And what a joy it was to do some reminiscing with Rod about his second Grand Slam, especially in 69, and then
other parts of his career, and he talked a bit about Roger Federer as well. And so I hope it'll be an absorbing listen for all of you out there, because Rod, to me, I never tire of listening to him.
Yeah, no, me neither. I'm sure it will be. And hey, thanks. It's been nice to share a recording booth with you.
I enjoyed it, Nick. We'll do it again soon.
All right. Well, thanks to Steve Flink. Also, thanks to Savannah Guthrie for joining us. Another thanks to Stan Smith. Of course, Indian Wells in Miami to come. You can find us on Apple Podcasts. Also, go to Audio Boom, and that's where we live. Thanks for listening. This has been another episode of Courtside, and we'll talk to you all again soon.